how about we don't try and make food perfect, because it's not perfect, just like life's not perfect.
If you're recycling, that's awesome, but you also need to look at all these other pieces, and you don't have to be doing them perfectly.
The first step is reduce, then reuse, then recycle. They are in order.
Get inspired by people fighting to make this world better for everyone. This is Unwasted with Imperfect.
Hello and welcome back to the Unwasted podcast. It's my honor every week to talk to experts in food, sustainability, and waste. And this week, I'm really excited to talk about one of my favorite aspects of building a more sustainable and equitable food system, which is community gardening. Today's guest has a wealth of knowledge and experience in gardening as well as community activism. Ron Finley, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, thank you, thank you for having me.
It's such a pleasure to have you here. I think I've heard recently, you know, in disclosure, we're recording this during the COVID-19 pandemic. This is recording's happening in early.
Should I have my mask on?
This recording's happening in early April, and I've actually been seeing recently a lot of people are suddenly really interested in gardening, right? Because suddenly the food supply is a bit shaken up. People are worried about, I don't know where my food comes from. I wish my food came from closer to me. So yeah. I think this is such a timely chat for us to have. I'd love to start with, you know, when did you first start gardening?
Well, I mean, how far you want to go back? I mean, we can go back to when I was a kid. I mean, that really was my first side hustle in junior high school. I used to do people's, you know, lawns, and, you know, I didn't know what I was doing. I just looked, but we used to mow the neighbors' lawns and, you know, pull their weeds and stuff like that. And, you know, in elementary school, we, you know how I'm sure they still do it, because I go around the world and people still do it. They have the dish, the glass dish, and they put a wet paper towel and you put the seeds in there and you get to watch them grow. You did that too, right? And so, I mean, you think that's my first gardening experience. But the thing about it, with lessons like that, they didn't tell us what to do after we saw that bean grow. They didn't say, hey, now take these out to the garden at your school and plant it, and you will have 1,000 beans. So all through life, we've been getting these half-assed lessons, you know? So imagine if you would have been empowered as a child with the rest of that lesson, the effect that it might have had on you to this day, because it has to me.
Yeah. I love that idea of closing the loop, looking at the full life cycle of a plant, not just how do you start a bean in a dish.
And why?
Yeah, because we're not gonna feed our people with beans and dishes. Let's be real.
Exactly. So it's like that, and just imagine you're in a community that damn near their whole existence is getting those kind of lessons.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's what this is about, is changing that kind of paradigm. You know, changing what do we value and why do we value it. You know, what are you truly pledging allegiance to?
Yeah. Totally. You know, in terms of values in your community, you know, what made you decide to start a community garden in South Central? Like, what was your inspiration for that?
Well, it wasn't South Central. It was where I live. It just happened to be South Central. And
that's a good point.
I got tired of anything I wanted. Anytime I wanted something healthy, it was like, okay, what am I going to eat? What am I going to go? And it's like, damn, you get in a car and it just became normal. You know, it's almost like if you build it, they will come. So it's not in my neighborhood. So I would go to the neighborhood where I could get healthy food.
Yeah.
And just one day it just snapped. Why the hell do I have to go here to get anything healthy when I should be able to go around the corner like the people who live in this neighborhood that I'm going to?
Yeah.
And it was little things. You know, hitting you upside the head and slapping you in the face, the back of the head real lightly. But, you know, I definitely remember that clearly. And it's like, okay, the hell with this. And that's kind of the thing that set me off. And I wound up starting an organization that we start putting gardens in people's homes for free. And after that, that's when I started the Ron Finley. I left there and started the Ron Finley Project.
Amazing. As I understand it, you ran into some legal opposition from the city of Los Angeles. Is that true?
Yeah, that's kind of legendary now. Yeah, I got in. Well, it happened twice, though. That's why it really came at me. I put, it's called parkways in different cities. I don't know what city you guys in.
I live in South Berkeley right now. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So in Berkeley, you have parkways too.
Yeah.
And it's for people that don't know, it's that strip of grass between the street and the sidewalk. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times they have trees, and some people call them hail strips. And mine, you know, I have a long one. I'm like, I have like 150 feet by 9 feet. And I said, so I planted it not knowing that it was against the law. And I put banana trees and, you know, amaryllis flowers and jasmine. And I wanted to walk out and just be assaulted with beautiful smells. And I wanted to see birds and lizards like I'd had when I was a kid. And then a neighbor complained, and I wound up, long story short, with a warrant I had to report to court. And basically I had to take my whole garden out the first time. Second time, which was probably, I don't know, 7 years later, I did it again. And they realized and say, oh, this guy, he's done this before. Yeah. So bam. So yeah, that's what happened. And through that, I said, I'm not taking it out, so bring it. So I got a lot of press from, you know, Wall Street Journal, LA Times, New York, you know, all over the place, NPR. It was just, they were just on it. And wound up getting a law change where now you can plant edibles on your parkway in the city of Los Angeles. With what, like you said, with what's happening right now, I haven't had any funding from that. The city hasn't given me anything, or, you know, and I get very little funding even to do what I do. I probably am my biggest, the biggest financer of my nonprofit. And I see now that all cities everywhere need to get behind this because of this situation. Hopefully this is going to open their eyes. It's like, you can't eat no diamonds. Okay. So, and I say, so what do we truly value? You can't eat those brand new, you know, tennis shoes either. So, I think this is going to switch what we truly value and realize that if you truly, truly care about your constituents, your the people at your church, wherever you, if you care about these massive groups of people, you will get people to back to growing food, you know, and sharing in that food. So, yeah.
Yeah.
And hopefully, it's terrible that something like this is happening because it's devastating.
Yeah.
But I think there's going to be a lot of good to come out of it. It's terrible that it's almost like the phoenix rising, where the whole thing has to burn down for the phoenix to rise and flourish. And it's that part. It shouldn't have had to come to this.
Yeah.
At all.
No, that's well said, though. Sometimes it takes a shakeup to realize how central something like food really is. And, you know, we've definitely seen that at Imperfect, that, you know, we got started to fight food waste in large part because food was getting wasted because people weren't valuing it. They weren't really respecting the amount of work and labor and sweat it takes to grow anything. You know, that bean in that dish, that head of lettuce, the banana, the strawberry, like all of those take a tremendous amount of work.
We're not trained to value food. We don't. Yeah. I was in a conference in San Francisco. You know, you were talking about the labor that goes in. I was in a conference in San Francisco, and they were talking about the farm workers and this and that. And I'm like, so, and it's generally these conferences, generally a bunch of academics, usually more white men than anything.
Yeah.
And I said, so why are you here telling their story? We're in San Francisco. We can find some farm workers right up the street. So I said, why aren't they here telling their own story? Because I don't need to hear your version of their life. Hmm. You know, let them tell us where they come from. And people don't know. You got people in these fields, man, that's breathing in these pesticides, that having miscarriages, doing all kinds of stuff. I mean, a lot of them right there, going to the bathroom right there while they're in the field. Back bent all day long. And it's like when you're looking at that beautiful head of lettuce and it's wet and got water drips and it's got that beautiful light on it in the store, you don't see. You don't even think about how did that head of lettuce, like you're saying, how did it get there? What was the toll on somebody's life? And how much did they get paid? Hmm. So these are the things that people need to realize.
Yeah, totally.
What is the true cost of food?
Yeah, and I think gardening is such a powerful primer in that, because anytime I've ever tried to grow something, it's tremendously humbling, and you feel at times embarrassed, you feel a little ignorant, the plant's not doing what you think it'll do or what you want it to do, it's a struggle to figure out how much to water it, how often to water it, how much sun or what type of sun it needs, and these things quite literally ground you, and I couldn't agree more that and some of them, I think everybody benefits from that direct exposure to here's what it takes to grow food. Because on some level, that's just like such an inoculation of gratitude also.
It is. I mean, just like you when you were saying that, the thought that came to my head, I started a mango seed and it finally, you know, back in November. And so now I have this maybe 6-inch, 5-inch tree with it. It was healthy, had beautiful leaves. And I thought it was too early to put it in, you know, the environment. And I covered it, and now some of the leaves have dried up, and I don't know. And now I'm like, oh no, it's got one leaf hanging on. Yeah. And it's only, like I said, it's only like 5 inches. And I'm like, oh damn, I took all this time, and did I just kill this tree? You know, so these are, I tell people, they don't look at them as mistakes, look at them as lessons.
Yeah. Know? Absolutely. That's really well said. And yeah, I had a little mint pot out on my porch, right. And I was convinced I killed my poor mint. And I thought mint was the most resilient herb. It went into hibernation. It was just this desiccated, like all the stems. But the other day, all new leaves budded across the whole thing. So the mint was fine, but I had to learn that lesson of like, trust the mint. It'll be okay. But like, learn how to better water it. You know what I mean? Like, and keep an eye on it, like pay attention to it.
It's basically trust nature, because nature always wins.
Ever.
Nature always. They got mushrooms growing in the reactors of Chernobyl. Yeah. You know, it's like nature's that, you know, ask those people in Pompeii, you know, does nature does nature always win?
Yeah.
I mean, and that's what we need to get back to, is getting back to ourselves. Because when you get back to nature, you do get back to yourself, because we're nature. And that's what I think a lot of people forget. They forget that we are nature. We do decompose just like a leaf does.
You know? Yeah. No, that's really, really well put. You know, once you got this garden off the ground in your community, like what was the reaction like? What was the reaction from the neighborhood?
It was like, why the hell are you doing this? You know, some people, but mostly people were amazed, because a lot of people still in Southern Cal have that Midwest or Southern roots. A lot of people during the migration, they came to Cali.
Yeah.
And so to see this, it took, what I noticed is, first of all, it made me become like an urban anthropologist or urban sociologist, because I got to see how people, when you put a beautiful space in, how they react. So I literally got to study that. But it took people back to where they came from. Yeah. Man, I remember I used to grow the collard greens with my dad, you know, when I was in Texas, or, you know, so I heard so many of these stories where people had touched the soil constantly. That's what they did.
Yeah.
But with this garden, it brought those visions and those memories back. And even having those memories, I'm sure you've experienced, you have that taste also, that you remember how that tomato tasted just came out the garden. So it did that. But then I also have the people who will see, I don't know, 12-foot sunflower, and the first thing they think about is to break it. Or I have this person that's been coming by lately, and they cut off all the heads of my sunflowers. You know,
no.
No, 90 days. Yeah, exactly. Oh. You wait 90 days and then bam. So I have, and that's hard to deal with. And it's like, okay, why? I'm not. And you can't let one or two people stop you from doing it, but it's hard, especially when you wait that long. Because to me, my garden outside on the parkway is basically an art installation.
Yeah.
And it's also an environment where people can see what's possible compared. If you look across the street and see this barren land, and then you look on my side, you're on my side of the street, and you see, I don't know, pear trees and almond trees and apricots and figs and sugarcane and lemongrass and, you know, kale and, you know, I don't know, five different kinds of spinach, artichokes. So it shows you that these environments are by design. This poverty is by design. These neighborhoods, the way they are, is by design. Hmm. And we can change that design. And that's basically what I want. That's why I put that garden out there. It's for people to see the possibilities. I mean, I literally changed the ecosystem at my place because, and I didn't know that was a part of it. You know, I come from fashion design. I have a designer background. I was a fashion designer most of my life.
Yeah.
But this is still designing, and that's what people don't get. These environments are by design. So I ask people, so what do you think cities are designed for? Oh, people. And I'm like, oh, wrong. Cities are not designed for people. And most architects I talk to, they don't even realize that. Hmm. That they're not designed because they weren't trained. They're designed for commerce.
Yeah, and cars, especially in Southern California, right? It's designed to get cars moving around.
Commerce. Move this product, move this, put the grid down and move it. I said, it's not designed for people. Certain neighborhoods are designed. Certain communities are designed for people.
Yep.
But most of it is designed for commerce. We got to move stuff. So, yeah.
That's really well said that on some level, gardening is an exercise in realizing what type of space any of us could design if we were actually in control. That on some level, it's about waking up to that and taking a bit of ownership for that. Because, I mean, speaking for myself, like I think sometimes living here in the Bay Area, I feel kind of very much like a victim or just like the space shapes me that I don't get to shape it. It's like, you know, in the Bay Area as an example, like public transit's not that great. Like we have the Bay Area Rapid Transit, but it's pretty woefully under equipped for how many people ride it, where people actually live, where they actually work. And to your point, like what types of errands people might want to do versus right now are just able to do with the transit. So I love this example of gardening because it is such a powerful, real, like we all create the city as much as the city creates us, but it's so easy to forget that, I think.
No, it is because mostly we came to cities to work. We're living on top of each other.
Yep.
And I said, let's replicate the forest, you know, let's, you know, biomimicry. What would Mother Nature do? Let's live like that, you know, and people, everybody, sustainable. Oh, we want a sustainable life. You want this? And I'm like, no, I don't want no damn sustainable life. That means your life doesn't change. That means it just stays the same. I said, I want a regenerative life, just like this planet does every 24 hours. It regenerates. Yeah. You know, but we're not taught that. And people are like, what the hell is that? And I said, okay, I'll break it down. This you'll understand it. Okay, you got a bank account, right? You got two. So you got a sustainable bank account or you want a regenerative bank account? Huh. And they immediately laugh. So, yeah, I get it. I say, yeah.
Yeah.
So your sustainable one is there. It ain't going nowhere. But it ain't giving you no dividends. It's not giving you no return on investments.
Yeah.
You know, but just your regenerative one is doing it's regenerating every day, every time. So that's how we need to do our gardens, and that's how we need to do our lives.
That's super powerful. And, you know, an analogy that comes to my mind when you said that was the idea of soil. I think a lot of industrial ag runs in this kind of linear approach to soil of like you create chemical fertilizer, you put it in the ground, you grow something, and then you deplete the ground, and then you kind of just wait to create more chemical fertilizer. But what I love about, you know, organic ag and the community gardening model is you show people that, no, like all of your scraps and tidbits and whatnot go into the compost pile and you just create more soil and you create more fertilizer and look to create a circle instead of just these like quote unquote efficient lines that in the end are kind of like not, like to your point, they're not regenerative. They're like sustainable, but not like in the long, long term.
There's no trash. And that's what I try to communicate when I work with people on design. And it's like you said earlier, you were saying that we can design the spaces. Yeah. Like if I'm doing a workshop, sometimes I'm at somebody's home, we should do. And the guy said, well, where should I put this? I'm like, I don't know, where you want to put it. It's your garden.
Yeah.
You know? So we think we need position. I said, well, it's purple and it's going to be 10 feet. So you walk out your door, where do you want to see it? So even designing paths,
yeah,
we don't design like a river flow. You know, people design angular. So they'll walk and then there's a sharp angle. And I'm like, how'd that feel? When you just walked that, how did that feel? I'm like, it made me feel, I remember, you know, so I think like water, you know, how does water flow?
Yeah.
And, you know, nothing in nature really has these straight lines that we're designed to see all the time.
Yeah.
So of course that's how our mindset works. And my whole thing, okay, how would you want to live? That's what you design. What would you want to see? That's how you design. So you put it there and it's not that difficult. So, yeah.
No, that's huge. Yeah. I think, yeah. Follow nature, follow the flow. Like don't make it, I think that's like, again, a powerful lesson about gardening is it's not necessarily about imposing your will as much as it's about like learning and kind of like having the cycle of like seeing, trying, learning from your results and then adjusting as necessary. Just like you said, like water, you know, if there's a rock, you don't like try to bore your way through the rock, you flow around it. And that's, exactly. That's fine. That's really awesome. You know, I think one thing I really love and respect about your work is that you're raising awareness about food deserts, or as my friend Olympia Osset calls them, food apartheid. You know, this idea that food is not, almost to your point earlier, by design in some areas, food is not nearly as accessible as other areas. And so for folks that haven't heard about this issue or don't know as much about it, can you share a bit like about the state of food accessibility in Los Angeles? And you know, why did you seize upon that as something to address?
Well, I call them food prisons, you know, because you need permit, you can't get anything. It's like you have to leave out of your cage to get anything healthy. That, again, going back to where we started, that's why I started it, because why should I not be able to eat healthy if I want to?
Yeah.
And it made you realize that a lot of the stuff that we're experiencing is by design. Hmm. You know, we have situations where there was a big store here, a supermarket that they were buying. They had affluent neighborhoods in the Marina area. If they didn't sell their meat a certain time, they would bring that meat to relabel it, boom, and bring it to our side of town to sell it in their stores in our side of the town. So, and that's real. You know, yeah. We had an organization, Community Coalition. They did a whole investigation on that. And so this is the kind of things. It's basically, you realize that they don't care about the people in these neighborhoods. There's no underserved neighborhoods. I went to a mayor's conference and I said, okay, why are there underserved neighborhoods? He says, oh, that starts with that. I said, no, it's real simple. They're underserved because you don't serve them. That's the only reason. There's no other reason that they're underserved. You can serve them just like you serve these other communities. You choose not to.
Yeah.
And that's why I got into this. So the whole thing is do it for yourself. They're not coming. You know, they're not coming to save you. Hmm. You got to save yourself. And that philosophy is where I started growing, you know, I started growing food. And that's, like I said, on the street so people could see it. So people could see how beautiful it is. So people can see how easy it is. Now you're sharing with your neighbors. So for the food desert concept, it's by design.
Yeah.
You know, if you really cared about this population, you would want them more healthy, you know, and they don't. Hmm. So they don't put certain things there, but the dialysis clinics are right there with neon lights, like it's a casino.
Oh my. Yeah.
You know, so that's why these places are conveniently by design and a lot of people are making money on them. That's what happens.
Yeah, So for someone out there who has learned about this or is maybe learning about it right now and is pretty upset and like wants to address it, you know, what's your advice to them? Is it like you said, you got to just take it on yourself, or is there like how would you go about addressing it?
I mean, don't sitting around being upset is not going to do anything. I mean, we need to get together, start coalitions where we can change it. And that's basically what the Ron Finley Project is about, is changing that. Oh, those people, if they could eat better, there's nothing here to eat. There's nothing, it's impossible to eat better. So just like anything, you're going to adapt to what's around you. So my whole thing is advocate for these communities to be better. And to me, if these communities are healthy, everybody benefits. And I don't know why they don't see that. It's like the same thing with the so-called the rich and the poor. Usually the people up on top of the hill, their money comes from the middle or the bottom of the hill. And I tell them, you should be more like cattle ranchers who take care of their cattle, because that's where their money comes from. You don't really take care of your cattle. So I said, ask Marie Antoinette how that should work for her.
No, that's such a great point. And
they don't see it as, if these people are healthy and living and happy, that you're gonna make even more money because they're gonna live longer. So a lot of it is ingrained racism, a lot of it, most of it.
Yeah, in my analysis, it seems like on some level we're set up in the system now where people think it's profitable to give people dietary disease by selling them, you know, processed junk food, and then it's profitable to treat said disease with the dialysis clinic, with the diabetes drugs, with all this stuff. But
follow the paper.
Yeah, exactly. If you follow the money and see where the receipts are, it's pretty clear who's benefiting. But to your point, the irony there is, like, if you eat a fundamentally
person. But do you think there was a group of people that got together and decided, ooh, we all could benefit? I mean, it's so because it works so damn good that it can't be happenstance, you know? It just works it's a perfectly working machine. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, it's certainly troubling. But I mean, to your point earlier, the irony is always that, like, it would be a lot healthier for everybody to not get the diseases in the first place and then not require the treatments. However, the weird economic paradox of that is, well, it's like, oh, but they're not paying for the diabetes drugs. It's like, yeah, because they don't have diabetes. Yeah, like, that is a victory. That is not a loss. But the economics of it would say, oh, well, but our snack sales are down and our diabetes drug sales are down. It's like, yeah, and that is a victory for humankind.
Exactly.
But yeah, I 100% feel you, and I think it's about shifting these paradigms. And I think,
and there's another thing, again, shifting your values.
Yeah,
these values.
Yeah, totally. And you know, this is something I think is so admirable about community gardens, is they're like a microcosm experiment in shifting values of, like, what if food sovereignty was here today, as opposed to like this thing that I'm going to maybe think about, discuss, or feel upset about. It's like, no, I'm going to do something literally in my soil today. And I think that it's a powerful exercise in sustainability, obviously, but also just honestly, like, democracy of, like, I can be an agent of change. And I think that's so important, and just really tip my hat to you for that. I mean, let's talk about the future here. Like, what is your hope for the future of gardening in America? Like, what would you love?
I don't do hope. I mean, we're based on this capitalist system, right?
Yeah.
Can you take hope to the bank and say, hey, I got a whole bucket of hope here. What you going to give me? You know, I do opportunity. You know, people need opportunity. They don't really, people like, and I've had people argue, and that's cool. And I understand their concept, but if you give somebody an opportunity to change some shit rather than the hope that they're going to change, they're going to smash it. And
it's a good point.
My hope is that we all get the opportunity to be able to live the life that we choose to live and design a large part of that life that we want to live. And I think that's what's going to come out of of this COVID thing right now is people are sitting at home for so long, they're going to realize, damn, why was I on that freeway for 4 hours any damn way? You know, going back and forth to work and then getting home and throwing something in the microwave. Well, now they were, what's truly valuable? You know, they're going to realize you can't eat those diamonds. You know, what's truly valuable? It's like my family here and this love and my relationships in this time. So now I think we're going to have a lot of creativity coming out of this situation. I think we now have the opportunity to more so design the lives we want to live rather than the ones that have been designed for us. I have not been off of my property since 3/11. You got people who are now at home and it's devastating because their financing has been devastated. But even that, it's like, I'll do a talk and I'll ask kids, okay, so when you're in this college, okay, so now you're going to go get this job. Okay, you got the jobs. When are you successful? When I get to be a manager. Okay, so no, but what about a senior manager? What about the vice manager, president, man? And I'm like, do you realize that you'll never be successful if you still live in this mindset? That you'll never, because you see that Mary has an office with a window in it, and you're in a cubicle. And then I only need to be like Mary. And then you see John has a corner office with four windows. And it's like, and so you keep going. I said, so when are you successful? And no, nobody can say. I said, exactly. I'm successful today because I woke up this morning, period. I said, you can decide your success and not let the system decide it for you. And that's what I'm doing. Man. It's you know, we got to detach from that. And I think a lot of what we're going through now, people are going to detach from that mindset that, okay, now I'm successful. No, your ass is breathing. You here, you're healthy. Your people around you are healthy. You got love. You know, consider that a success. We're not trained to operate in the present. You go to school for what? The future. From elementary school, you go to school. Everything we do is for the future. Nobody tells you to stop and smell the lavender today and enjoy. Well, that lavender plant, I got success there. We're not trained like that. You know, that's not being successful. But I'm saying you can determine and define what your success is.
No, that's super well said. I'd love to dig into the piece you brought up about, you know, this moment with COVID of realizing what our values are or what our values maybe could or should be. Like, where do you see opportunities specifically in the food and gardening realm? Like, where do you see opportunities for folks to really kind of seize control and do things differently coming out of this?
Oh, no, it's happening already. I'm hearing about people, seeds are being bought out. I'm like, but people, you had to do that 4 months ago. You know what I'm saying? This is not Jack and the Beanstalk. You're not going to buy those beans and throw them on the ground and they're going to grow. But no, it has people's paradigm and values have shifted with this. That's a beautiful thing. How long is that shift going to last until we go back into it? How long should this last? Are we going to realize that these rivers need to flow? And the fact that there's dolphins in Venice, are you kidding me? Dolphins in the Venice canals. It's like they haven't seen that in, say, 40, 50 years or some crazy shit. And you can't even see. You ever been to Venice? You can't even see down in the water. Now it's clear. Look at how clear all the air. I mean, who is the virus here? And we got these companies, the food companies with everything in it supposed to be healthy, GMO, blah, blah, blah. No GMOs. And organic, but then the package that they put this stuff in never, ever deteriorates.
Yeah.
And where do you find that? In the septic systems, in the trash, on the street. So that needs to be addressed. So you got this beautiful, healthy product, but what you're putting it in, you know, is never going to decompose. We got a lot to work and we got a lot to think. And I think there's a lot to think about.
Yeah.
You know, we're going to have a lot of people coming out. You see how many people are going live now on Instagram and thing. I mean, it's incredible.
Yeah. Yeah. That's super. It's a great, great moment. Great moment of opportunity for sure. You know, for the amateur gardeners that are all coming out of the woodwork right now in this COVID moment and trying to grow their own food, you know, what type of advice do you have? Like if for somebody really wants to start gardening, but is unsure of where to start, you know, what would you say to them?
Don't grow anything you don't like.
Yeah.
You know? And if you want to see something fast, if you're working with kids, radishes, they're one of the fastest growing things.
Oh yeah.
And it's simple. It's not as complex as people make it. I mean, that's what I say, who's in the forest? Are elves in the forest, you know, turning soil? And no, it's really simple. It's going to happen. I mean, probably 40% of the stuff that's growing in my garden right now, I didn't even plant, you know, because it just came to the garden. I got artichokes and I got stinging nettle and chickweed and all kinds of mellow, all kinds of different things that just came to the garden. And every year they come back. The simplest advice is to me is to do it and fail. You know,
yeah.
That's what you want, but you're going to get seduced by that garden. You're going to be, it's almost like some people compare it to having kids where they go out and they finally see their sprouts, you know, they put a bean in the ground of water and they see the sprout come up. And it's like, oh my God. I saw a girl cry when she grew her first carrot, you know,
yeah.
So, and to show kids this, you're showing them the magic, the alchemy of this planet. When they can put a tiny seed in the ground that you barely can see, and all of a sudden they have a carrot. I mean, you got to think about that, right? That's magic, you know.
Yeah.
What else can you call it? But it's also one of the simplest things, and that's what Mother Nature does.
No, that's a really great point. I love what you said about just make peace with failure. That's something gardening has taught me, that look, it's not going to go your way all the time, and that's the point, and that's okay.
Right.
You know, what's not okay is you feeling broken by that one thing that gets eaten by slugs or doesn't get enough sun or gets too much sun. Like, you got to move past that and kind of let your ego fall so that the plants can rise, right? Like, but that's a hard thing to do.
Well, see, I'm dealing with rats. I'm dealing with possums. I'm dealing with raccoons, birds, slugs, aphids, and these damn cabbage worms. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
I mean, desecrating all my brassicas, especially collard greens. I mean, just you come out, you know, in one night, there are these little green worms. Anybody see those butterflies? They think they're butterflies. They're actually cabbage moths. They're white with gray spots. Oh, it's so pretty. I'm like, hello. And they leave their eggs on your plants. And all of a sudden, and then these worms are like camouflage, because they mix in right with the plant. They're the same color. You can't see them, but they desecrate your garden. And that's what I've been fighting lately. Hmm. But it is, it's a jungle out there.
Yeah.
You know,
it's an interesting reminder too, that like, the power of food, like other creatures want it too. Like we had a plum tree in our backyard growing up, a Santa Rosa plum tree. And every summer, every July and August, the squirrels would just swarm it and be snacking on the plums. And I remember as a little kid getting annoyed and angry at them. And I try to, you know, throw stuff at them to get them to go away. But on some level, it just also reminded me, like, of course they want plums. They're plums. They're delicious. Like, of every bird and squirrel would want plums.
But
like,
learn how to share.
Yeah,
you know, that's the thing. They don't have no. They don't know how to share. I have two nectarine trees, and last year they got most of the nectarines, probably rats. And then I have a tangerine, and I got three tangerines off that tree, you know, some months back. That was it. Every tangerine was gone. But see, and then the one of the worst culprits is this thing. What do they call humans? You know, that's especially if you're my garden on the street. Somebody came and took every last tangerine off the tree overnight. And it's probably 200 and some tangerines.
Oh, no.
So we have to deal with that stuff too. And the neighbor's like, damn, Ron, you took all the tangerines? I'm like, no, I didn't even get one of them overnight. So we have that to deal with.
Yeah. You know? All species got to learn how to share, ourselves included, maybe first and foremost. Again,
what do you value? I mean, there's enough for everybody. And if we all start growing and doing it collectively, we will exceed man's need for greed. And that's what we've been trained that there's not enough for everybody, that and to be selfish and to be greedy and not to share. I mean, that's how we've been raised, you know, basically.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. I mean, again, coming back to imperfect and food waste, like there's more than enough for everybody. Like our company exists because there's just so much food that literally people are throwing it out at home, in the factories, on farms, you know, and it's like there's such an opportunity here for all of us to just see that and be like, hey, there's more than enough. Let's just think a little differently, think a little compassionately. And again, to your point, design the system that serves us people, not just like greater commerce somewhere far away. You know, like design a system that works for you and your community where you are. And like that's kind of that's all we can do, right? You know, it's like be part of that.
It's the least we can do. And
that's the least we can do.
I mean, and literally that's what the Ron Finley Project is about. Just that. Is showing, more so than anything, is showing people that is inequity.
Yeah. You
know, and equality.
Yeah.
That's what this is about, showing this, like, there's enough, you know, for everybody. You don't have to take everything. You don't have to steal my food off the street, because you're not stealing it. It's on the street. I got there. But also, why don't you think about, you know, I called a guy, you know, a month or so ago. I just happened to be outside, and the guy pulls his truck up and gets out, has his machete, and he cuts out my whole rack of bananas.
No.
Yes. Throws them in the back of his truck. And I kind of lost it, because I think you take, when you do finally get somebody, you take it out, everything out on them, the people you did.
Yeah.
And I went in, and I'm like, I said, did you grow? Is this yours? Do you know where this, you just come and you took, you know, I mean, bananas take forever to grow. And I said, why don't you take a finger? I mean, a hand. Why don't you just take a hand or two? Why you have to take the whole rack? And I literally took it out of his truck and said, next time ask.
Yeah.
You know? But yeah, he had planned it. You know, they saw him, come back, you know, and that's the kind of thing that why do we have to train? Why do I have to tell somebody to stop cutting my sunflowers? Couldn't let everybody else enjoy them. Why do I have to tell you don't take all the food?
Yeah.
No. Yeah.
It makes you realize how, in some ways, we're all still learning the lessons they like tried to teach us in like kindergarten and first grade, you know, like respect other people's space, like don't take their things without asking. Like we're all still on that learning track.
That's a good one.
Yeah. I mean, like just closing it out with food waste, you know, what advice do you have for folks who want to reduce food waste in their lives? Like, how do you reduce food waste? You know, what tips and tricks would you want to share?
It's hard. It's terrible, because they're like, Ron, don't you want to throw this away? I'm like, no, you know, from cardboard to paper to if it's organic, if it came from nature, it can go back. And I do everything, like if I'm like, even with cardboard.
Yeah,
I'll put it in the I'll soak it in water, put it in the bottom of the pot when I'm potting, because it's going to retain the water more so, almost like a sponge. That's what cardboard has, those the squishies in it.
Yeah.
the air spaces. So you're building up an environment for worms, but you're also saving water and soil with that. Far as I'll even dig holes in the ground and put like my scraps in those holes in the garden. Just, you can dig a trench and just put your scraps in that trench and fold the soil back over. You don't have to decompose. It is even they have these worm bins now, the smaller ones, you know, some people have them in home.
Yeah.
You can get worm bins. That's going to turn your compost, your scraps into black gold. I have, I mean, all everything I cut down goes, just like in the forest, it goes right back into the forest. They can look up Google cultures, which is amazing way they've actually reforested deserts making Google cultures.
Wow.
And it's a form where, like fallen trees, where you take these trees and you stack them on top of each other and you wet them. So imagine you have this much space, right? So imagine I've stacked these trees and all of this organic matter up. And now look how much space I have to plant. I have all of this to plant now. And it pulls moisture out of the air because there's moisture in the air. So it pulls it out into these mounds, and you plant the whole mounds. And all of a sudden, this stuff inside is holding the water. And then it breaks down after a while. And now you have this beautiful, fluffy soil that's just amazing. And that's another way to compost your scraps. But even composters, I mean, I'm not a fan of the I haven't really found one of those tumbler ones that work for me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but somebody did make me, I guess they call them a reactor, where it has the thing where they learn compost needs air in it.
Yeah.
And someone made me this, and I think it came from Davis, the university. And it's like 6 feet tall, and it's made with wire and weed cloth, and it's got 8 pipes in it with holes in them. So the compost, you fill it with compost. And so the holes they suck air in from the bottom because it's on top of a pallet. So it's getting air all the way through the process. And they have a timer where it sprinkles water like every day for a minute or something. And the compost, it just breaks down so much faster.
Yeah, it sounds super optimized. Like every aspect of it is kind of optimized for decomposition.
Exactly. And but there's no reason. I mean, even if you do it with your neighbors, you know, if you have a collection somewhere, and do it with your neighbors, and then you guys share the compost that comes out of that. You know, people don't see that as a resource, and that's what we have to. With the only resource, a lot of times that we're trained to think of is money. That's the only resource. We don't look at the single most important thing to your life, which is air. We don't look at that as a resource. We don't look at soil as a resource. We don't look at water because you turn on the faucet and it just comes out. So we don't put a value to that, that it's the value. I mean, there's nothing more valuable than air. Nothing. No. But we're not trained that. So of course food waste or trash, it doesn't have a value, but it does have a value, and it is a significant value, and we can change it. I mean, I got compost happening everywhere, all over my garden, everywhere. Something to be decomposed.
Got to respect the soil.
You do.
I love that. No, that's amazing. This has been such a great chat. I feel like I could go on forever, but I do want to be respectful of your time. And also, I do have some fun closer questions just to wrap it up and get to know you a little bit better. So let's hit the speed round here.
Bam, bam.
All right. Is there anything you would encourage folks listening to follow up with or explore in more depth on their own time? Any kind of homework or asks like that?
As soon as you hear to the end of this podcast, go out and plant some.
Amazing. What's a positive change you've made in your life in the past year that you think more folks listening should try?
Positive change that I made in the last year. I get to speak around the world and tell people about gardening. and I literally get to see it happen. I literally get to see the results. I mean, that's the beautiful part, that you do something and you're like, oh, I'll never get to see that. But I literally get to see the results of that. So inspiring people.
I love that. If you're cooking for somebody and you want to make them feel loved, what are you going to make for them?
The first thing that came to my mind were fresh organic blueberry pancakes.
Oh, wow.
With real maple syrup.
That sounds delightful. I'm in. When's breakfast? What ingredient could you not live without?
Air.
Air. Excellent. Maybe the ingredient, as you alluded to earlier. Yeah. What is your least favorite thing to waste?
Time.
What's your go-to karaoke song?
I don't do karaoke, but
let's reframe. How about like song to sing in the car by yourself, or maybe like while doing some dishes at home?
I don't know. It's funny when you ask that. Just James Brown came to mind, so probably Sex Machine. I don't know, some James Brown song. I don't know why that name. I don't know why James Brown came to my head.
No, James Brown's a great choice. Godfather of Soul, right? Who's somebody you admire tremendously?
The Big Payback. Yeah.
What now?
The Big Payback. That's what that's what this whole mission is about, The Big Payback.
Yeah, 100%. Who's somebody you admire tremendously, and what do you admire about them?
Me. I admire the fact that I'm still here. I mean, you got to realize that even doing with this, this is not a walk or a ride on the hay, man. This is kind of treacherous. You know, I mean, you think, why would growing food, putting in gardens be this? But if the people that have tried to stop me, or the larceny that's in the camp, or, you know, it's been treacherous, and it's hard. It's been hard as hell.
Amazing. Well, respect for keeping on despite all that. I love that.
And still we rise.
Well said. And I love that you admire yourself. That's amazing. That's something more of us, I think, need to do, right? Practice that self-admiration.
That's arrogant. That's conceit. You're not trained to do that. Because we're trained to believe that there's something else that gave us, and we're not supposed to take credit for anything at all.
Yeah.
And no, I got up this morning. Yeah, there's a force and a power to God, but I didn't have to go with it. I could have just stayed there. So definitely love thyself and appreciate what, you know, acknowledge. This is not enough acknowledgement of self, I think.
And finally, Ron, what are you grateful for this week?
The fact that we had this time, and that we're still here. I'm grateful for that. I'm grateful for the work that that I've done that brought you to me, and hopefully I'll get to share that tomorrow, and continue. I mean, my 5-year plan, as people are, what's your 5-year plan? It's like to wake up in the morning. You know, because if you don't wake up anymore, who gives a hell about your 5-year plan? You know?
Yeah. But
if you had a 5-year plan, you're going to write that on my to-do. It's like I, the fact that we're here, I mean, and I celebrate that. I am in the present.
Yeah.
That is the present. And we go back to, when are you successful? Because everything's in the future. Acknowledge and appreciate and right now, and respect the right now. We're not, none of our teaching is ever tell us to write the space right now, that time you're in right now. Love that, appreciate that, give honor and reverence to that. And that's what I try to do every day. You know, the fact, because we see it. We see people falling right now with this. We see it every day now. Enjoy. And appreciate and acknowledge where you are today, because this is our future right now.
Yeah. No, very well said, Ron Finley. Thank you so much for joining us today. Where can folks learn more about you and the work that you do?
I have a movie called "Can You Dig This?"
Amazing.
And we have and my website, ronfinley.com. Or just look, if you just put in The Gangster Gardener or Ron Finley, I'm going to pop up. So there's a lot, you know, people can see I've done a lot of talks and they're online. But, you know, my Instagram is the Ron Finley Project and Ron Finley HQ. So they can get at me.
Amazing. And we'll have links to everything we talked about today in the show notes and on our website, unwastedpodcast.com. And if you're listening, have any comments or questions, just shoot us an email at feedback@unwastedpodcast.com. Ron Finley, thank you so much. This has been a pleasure.
It's been mine.